The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Chatter. I'm Anna Hickey. This week, writer and journalist Christopher Miller on his book, The War Came to Us: Life and Death in Ukraine.
Yanukovych, the president at the time, ordered his riot police to storm the Independence Square, where these peaceful protesters had been sitting. And they came there and bludgeoned them. And there was quite literally blood running down the stairs of Kiev's Independence Square. There were no signs initially that it would become a revolution that would alter Europe and really set in motion all of the events that have played out since, including Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022 and the war that we're witnessing here in Ukraine right now. You know, I remember my phone ringing constantly. It was not only family and friends back home in the US checking in on me, but my Ukrainian friends asking me, "What do you know? Where should we go?" And at that moment, I didn't have a lot of answers.
Christopher Miller, welcome to Chatter.
Yeah, thank you.
So in your book, you write about your experience living and working in Ukraine when you were first sent there by the Peace Corps. Obviously, in the almost 15 years since, Ukraine has seen some significant changes. But thinking back to when you first got there, what was your first experience? What did you expect when you first arrived in the Donbass?
Yeah, actually, it was April 1st, 2010, when I arrived in Ukraine, first in Kiev, and then after a few months of Peace Corps language training and cultural lessons, I got sent out to eastern Ukraine, to a city called Bakhmut that a lot of people now know about because of the really brutal 10-month battle of the city that saw it unfortunately destroyed and occupied by Russian forces last year. But before it was one of the main battlegrounds in this war, it was a very peaceful city of more than 70,000 people. You know, just a provincial city. You know, outside of the country's capital, that I would say, you know, not a whole lot of people were talking about or really thinking about. And you know, to me, it felt like the other side of the world. I had been in journalism for a couple of years after graduating from university in Oregon, and decided to go off and have a little adventure for a couple of years. And the Peace Corps is a 27-month commitment. So I ended up in Ukraine, and I didn't choose. That's the other thing about the Peace Corps. You don't choose where you get to go, or at least at that point, volunteers didn't. So I was dispatched to Ukraine, and I didn't know anything about the place, about the people. I had never traveled to Eastern Europe at that point. It was all new. And for me, that was exciting. You know, making new friends, getting to know a place, you know, moving into a new apartment, learning a new language. And that was something that was very difficult for me as well. I learned Russian because the language predominantly spoken in Eastern Ukraine was Russian, even though, and maybe just a small detour, historically, you know, Russian was not the language of Eastern Ukraine. Ukrainian used to be, but it was the Russians who shipped in Russian workers and Russian citizens during the industrialization period decades and decades ago. So they sort of Russified the area. But when I arrived there, people were mostly speaking Russian or a mix of Russian and some Ukrainian called Surzhik. So that was a bit of a curveball, studying Russian, but then having to learn a mix of the two. No, it was a really interesting place, far off any beaten path. And it came at a really interesting moment for the country as well, the pro-Russian president, Viktor Yanukovych, who just several years earlier had fixed an election and sparked the Orange Revolution, had actually been democratically elected and came to power early in 2010. So I arrived just a couple of months after he took office. And I would say, generally speaking, the mood in the country was a bit downbeat, although some people in eastern Ukraine, where his base was, were very pleased with the fact that he had come to office. So it was an interesting moment when I think the direction of the country was still very uncertain. It looked as though it was sort of being pulled closer into or back toward Russia's sphere of influence. It wasn't the very European-minded, democratically oriented, Western European-oriented country that we know today. At that point, you know, war was still far off, and nobody was talking about the possibility of a Russian invasion. You know, in some places, some corners of eastern Ukraine, people were still talking very much about Ukraine and Russia being sort of brother nations. There was a lot of nostalgia for Russia and the former Soviet Union among older groups, pensioners in eastern Ukraine. And I would say, you know, one of the things that I found really interesting was that while it was sort of thought of as this kind of backwater, and far from Europe, there were a lot of young Ukrainians who were born in independent Ukraine and coming of age as young adults. And those were a lot of the people who I spent my time with. And that gave me, I guess, a sort of hope for Ukraine's future and for progress across the country, not only in Kiev, but also in provincial cities like Artyomovsk, which is what Bakhmut was called at the time before it returned to its historical name, Bakhmut, a few years later. I arrived then in 2010 and spent a couple of years there before relocating to the capital, Kiev, in 2012 and getting back into journalism as a foreign correspondent here in the capital. So the first part of the book that I wrote has a lot to do with those pre-revolution years between 2010 and 2013. So you learn a lot about Ukrainians, the culture, that political moment, how we got to the Euromaidan uprising that became the Revolution of Dignity.
And thinking about like the interesting moment that Ukraine was going through in that time period, there's one story in that first part of the book that really stuck out to me. And it was Ilya, the father of a student you taught, who was like brought out his Donetsk Krivorog Soviet Republic flag. And then some spoilers for later in the book, but you run across him later. And I just found that particular story incredibly interesting because it was, as you were saying, before the revolution, before there was any talk. So what was it like thinking about when he showed you his, I believe, AK-47 and his flag? What was it like to be in that moment? Did you have any expectations that that was something you're going to experience while you were there?
No, it really startled me at first. I mean, it's eastern Ukraine might seem and feel and be, truthfully, a bit of a wild place out there in the steppe. But to see a Kalashnikov rifle pulled out of the trunk of a car still, startles you when it happens. So I was taken a bit aback by that. But, you know, like I said, there were some people who had these feelings of nostalgia and of you know, the good old days in the Soviet Union and really wanted Moscow to sort of reign over at least this part of Ukraine. They were, I would say, you know, fewer and farther between than those who enjoyed their lives in an independent Ukraine, even if you know, most people were skeptical of Kiev and its politics and felt sort of forgotten, if not abandoned by the capital and politicians in Kiev. They still were not pro-Russian in the sense that they wanted Moscow to rule them, right? And I would say a lot of people were certainly not pro-Putin. But that said, there were these small contingents, little pockets of folks who did feel those things. And the father of one of my students. I call him Ilya. I didn't change many identities in the book, but I did for this family. Ilya, the father, invited me out for a barbecue with their family as a sort of thank you for teaching his kid in one of the schools that I was working at as a Peace Corps volunteer. And after several shots of his homemade moonshine, or what we call samagon, he took me over to his car and sort of gave me this lecture about how there used to be this independent republic in eastern Ukraine. And again, this is a bit of like revisionist history on his part too, right? But it was called the Krivoy Rog Republic, and it was sort of this breakaway statelet that had designed its own flag in the colors of black and blue and red. And he was telling me that he was part of this group that was a bunch of men, about 30 or 40 of them, in Donetsk region, so eastern Ukraine, where I was living, who were activists in the sense that they were sort of promoting the idea of this, the return of this breakaway statelet. And he said, you know, we've even got our own flag, and we're prepared to, you know, rise up and even fight for this and for our independence if necessary. And so, you know, he pops open the trunk of his old Soviet era Lada sedan, and he pulls out this flag and, you know, sort of explains it and the colors and their regional significance. And then after that, pulls out this, kind of dinged up old Kalashnikov rifle and suggests that we go and do some target shooting with it. An idea that I quickly, no pun intended, shot down and said, you know, I think we should move back to the barbecue. But it was an interesting moment. And honestly, I saw him several times after that because I worked at the school where his child was a student. But I didn't think that after I finished the Peace Corps and became a journalist and moved to Kiev that I would ever return to eastern Ukraine to report on a war, let alone bump into him, which is what happened some years later when I returned to the city of Bakhmut and was pulling in to a checkpoint manned by some Russian and pro-Russian fighters, and one of them happened to be him. And there's this somewhat tense moment where I've got guns drawn on me that moves to a bit more of a humorous situation when he realizes that I'm inside of the car and invites me to meet some of the men that he had described to me years earlier.
And I'm imagining that when you first saw the flag in that first encounter, you never ever thought that so many years later you would be coming across him in what would become an active war zone. But thinking back at that time period where it is this inflection moment for Ukraine, you kind of talk about ending up as a journalist in Ukraine. The way the book reads, it's almost on accident. As I'm reading these stories, it's that the path that you had, you just ended up being in the right moment in a lot of places to be able to take advantage of it. And so how did you end up becoming an investigative reporter? And then can you talk about the first time you received a bribe deal? Because I also found that story just so fascinating.
Sure. I didn't receive a bribe deal. I was offered. I was offered one. Sure. You know, I did plan on moving back into journalism after joining the Peace Corps and doing my 27 months as a Peace Corps volunteer. And as I mentioned, I had been a reporter in Portland, Oregon prior to joining the Peace Corps. So my plan in a nutshell was, because I had graduated in 2008 and the financial crisis had hit, and 2009 was not a great year either, and I needed to start paying student loans, and my journalism job at that time, to no surprise, did not pay very well. So I took a two-month kind of break to go have an adventure. And I thought I would come back to Portland and get a job at the state paper and, you know, start my life again. And, I did get back into journalism, but instead of going back to the US, I decided to stay in Ukraine because I just had such a great time in the Peace Corps. And I really got this itch to travel, to live abroad, to, I guess the sort of life of an expat and the unpredictability and the challenges that come with that sort of excited me still. And So after living in eastern Ukraine, I moved to Kiev. I started at this newspaper here. It's still around, but it's in a very different form currently. But it's called the Kiev Post, and it was sort of an expat English language newspaper, one of the sort of newspapers that popped up in the post-Soviet space after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Russia had the Moscow Times, Prague used to have the Prague Post. There was one in Budapest. There was one in other Eastern European countries. In Ukraine, it was the Kiev Post. It had been around for many years. There was an expat editor, a couple other expat reporters, and myself included, and then several Ukrainian journalists. And so there I really cut my teeth in doing investigative reporting, reporting on corruption here in Ukraine. At the time, of course, of which there was plenty to be reported on. I was doing some foreign correspondence. I had some strings for international outlets who wanted stories about, the geopolitics of Eastern Europe, stories about where Kiev fit into the conversation about Russia and the U.S. Anytime there was a big event that happened here, I'd get called on to sort of report or file a dispatch from here. And I did that for most of 2013. And I think it was the summer of 2013 when I was working on this, I guess what was my first big scoop. And what had happened was I received a tip that the Russians were trying to smear the American Westinghouse nuclear fuel company that was providing fuel rods to Ukraine to power its nuclear reactors. The Russians were trying to say that Westinghouse's American nuclear fuel rods were causing damage to Ukraine's nuclear reactors, and they were leaking. And in reality, what I had found out was that it was the Russian nuclear fuel rods that were being used alongside the American fuel rods. And because of their flexibility, for some reason, they were crashing up against the American ones and causing them to leak in some cases. So the story was a bit like what some pro-Russian and Russian sources were claiming, except it was kind of flipped on its head, right? And so the story that I wrote caused a big stink, and it got a lot of domestic coverage here. Russian media reported a lot about it. I think some Western publications picked it up, Reuters and some of the Wires, for example. And it got a lot of attention. And some days later, I was working on a follow-up story, and I got a weird phone call from someone claiming to be a person who worked closely with the Yanukovych government at the time, and he just wanted to meet and talk about my story, and just to make sure I had all of the information correct, and just for my knowledge, he wanted to explain some things. So I said, yeah, sure, we can go meet for coffee, and just to be safe, I took an editor with me, and we showed up at this coffee shop that was sort of out of the way, tucked in this corner behind the opera house, and it was a bit like a D-level spy flick where, I walked in and he was sitting in the very back corner booth in this coffee shop, and the lights were dimmed back there. And I don't know if he did that, but it was just kind of a dark cafe. And he's in this dark suit and he's just kind of stirring his tea slowly. And we sit down and he has a talk with us and says, you're not getting this quite right. And I'd like to make you an offer, if I may. And, that sort of piqued my interest. And he says, there's a very important campaign going on. It's this, black PR campaign. They call it, Chorny PR. And he said, if you're up for it, you're welcome to be a part of it. And it can be worth your while. It pays well, and he extends a $50,000 bribe to us, and my editor and I, are pretty shocked by this. It's a very brazen move, and we look at each other. And my editor, he was roughly my age, and we were both pretty young in our 20s at the time. And he couldn't hold back his excitement, and sort of had this grin on his face. Me, I was a bit more startled, and started looking over my shoulders to see if anybody was coming up behind us or watching us. And of course, we said, you know, thanks, but no thanks. However, now that we know that there is this smear campaign happening, and you've confirmed it for us, and this had been what a lot of my reporting was about, you know, I'd love to hear more. Who's involved? You know, what's the end game here? You know, who are you other than this person? I think you told me his name was Vladimir, which is an extremely common name, right? It's like the John of Eastern Europe. And he said, I don't know what you're talking about. And he just pulled out his wallet and put some money on the table to pay for his coffee or tea and got up and left. And I never heard from him again. I tried calling the number, you know, many, many times later, and it was disconnected. And we went back to the office and had a pretty good laugh and talked with another editor who thought, you know, wow, we're really onto something. And we were. And so I reported out that story. I think there were maybe two or three follow-ups. And I guess that was my first big scoop as a correspondent over here until, you know, a few months later, the Euromaidan protest began, and that all spun into, you know, the revolution.
Yeah, so thinking about the Euromaidan protest that started in like November 2013, when people first started showing up to protest, did you have any expectation of what it would eventually become? Were there any seeds at the beginning?
No, at the beginning, it was a protest of mostly young people, university age students or young professionals in their 20s, you know, holding signs on Independence Square. It was a demonstration. It was peaceful. There were chants and songs. You know, it was not violent yet. And it was not large. I would say, you know, anywhere from several hundred people to a few thousand people were coming out to the street, you know, every day for about a week or so. And there was no expectation that it would become anything like an uprising or a protest, a mass protest movement, or something resembling the Orange Revolution a decade earlier, right? Not at that point. It wasn't until the night of November 31st or December 1st or overnight then, when Yanukovych, the president at the time, ordered his interior minister and his riot police to storm the Independence Square, where these peaceful protesters had been sitting and sipping tea and talking amongst themselves. And again, these are mostly students, young people. And they came there and bludgeoned them. And there was quite literally blood running down the stairs of Kiev's Independence Square, or the Maidan, colloquially. And, you know, that really woke people up. And it was that violence, state-sponsored violence, that brought out tens of thousands of people over the course of the next several days. You know, there were a couple of protests that the Ukrainians you know, believe brought out as many as a million people. And it was a lot of people, just entire city blocks and buildings, you know, every corner is packed full of people. And it turned into an uprising, absolutely. And then, you know, a massive tent camp popped up, and it felt and looked a lot like the Orange Revolution a decade earlier. And you know, there was great unity on the square, and people were coming in, you know, carpooling from Western Ukraine or Southern Ukraine, Northern Ukraine, Central Ukraine, hopping buses, trains. Everybody wanted to be a part of it. And, you know, it was, at first it was, you know, very exciting and fascinating as a young reporter to be witnessing, you know, history. Things eventually grew more violent, which is something that I didn't foresee, and I don't think a lot of people did. And it was much more than the violence that the police waged in that first night. You know, eventually it would lead to the killings of several people, and then in late February, you know, dozens and dozens of people. But there were no signs initially that it would become a revolution that would, you know, I think alter Europe, that would, you know, lead to Russia's covert invasion of Crimea, you know, days after the revolution in Kiev, and really set in motion all of the events that have played out since, including Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022 and the war that we're witnessing here in Ukraine right now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout.
That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
And then thinking about the Little Green Men and the covert Russian invasion of Crimea in 2014, when that occurred, when you were living in Ukraine, what was the reaction of the Ukrainians that were around you as there was this kind of first invasion of Russian forces, or at the time, alleged Russian forces into a part of Ukraine? Did it really impact people in Kyiv, or was that like, that's so far away from us, it's kind of separate, it's kind of its own entity, you know, I'm not that concerned about it?
A little bit of both, to be honest. You know, it was, I mean, first in Kyiv, people were in a very celebratory mood, right? Yanukovych had been ousted by parliament after he fled the country. He was now in Russia. Protesters from Independence Square, the revolutionaries had gone to his walled, massive compound that was the size of Monaco, that nobody had seen or been inside of for years. And they were climbing, scaling the walls and opening the gate and flooding the premises and, you know, just getting their first glimpse at what this kleptocrat had done, what he had stolen. Billions and billions of dollars worth of state assets and money. And so there really was this celebratory mood that immediately shifted, people's attention to Crimea and caused a lot of confusion. At first, it wasn't clear what was happening. You used the word Little Green Men, which is the term that we use to describe the unmarked soldiers that were Russian soldiers that had snuck off their Black Sea base down in Crimea at the time, or been secretly airlifted in or driven in by boat by Russia. But you know, there wasn't even time really to grasp what the ouster of Yanukovych meant when a lot of people turned to Crimea and were trying to make out what was happening. I think we were all a little bit confused, and I quickly got on a plane and went down there to figure it out for myself. And I didn't know what I was going to experience when I arrived. And there's this scene that I paint in the book where I'm on this plane and I'm next to a veteran TV reporter, an older gentleman, and he's telling me, you know, I think you need to get ready for war. And I say to him, is that what we're going to find down there? And I get off the plane, and at the airport, there are very few passengers. It's mostly just airport employees, police officers. And then there are dozens of Russian soldiers masked and in their uniforms, but without insignia. And they've got assault rifles, of course. And these were the Little Green Men. And so as I moved across the city, I saw more and more of them, and it became more clear that there was this sort of covert, insidious invasion happening in real time across the peninsula. And every military base that I would go to, Ukrainian military base, that is, or police station, or outside of the government buildings, there would be more of these Russians. Some of them had already taken control of these buildings, or were trying to force Ukrainians at military bases to change sides, to surrender, at least to vacate, to be able to take over. And I think I was still young enough, naive enough to not really understand the seriousness of the situation. And in some ways that allowed me to not really be scared and just to go right up to a lot of these guys and interview them and to write about it. I think in this sort of very innocent, kind of eyewitness manner. I think if this happened now, and I'd at the age that I am in my late 30s and had gone down there, I think I may have taken a slightly different approach and maybe even been more cautious. I was naive enough, I think, to, run onto some military bases to do some reporting on what Russian soldiers were doing, to interview Ukrainians as they were besieged at the Belbek Air Base. And, all of that is written in detail in the book. And I'm certainly very glad that I was able to witness it. But it was a really unpredictable moment. I think in some ways, we're all very fortunate that it did not transform into the violence that we would see months later. But also, you know, there was this takeover that happened by Russia without a shot really being fired. And it did show just how weak Ukraine was in that moment. And I think that weakness and also the lack of a real response to show support for Ukraine on the part of the West and the United States at that moment really emboldened Russia. And I think led to what would come in just weeks later in Eastern Ukraine.
And so then thinking about what came just weeks later in apologies for the butchering of the language that I'm about to do, but in the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts.
Oh, you got them. No, that's good.
Phew. But thinking about kind of how what would then just become a near war in Eastern Ukraine, what was it like to transition from reporting at a place you mentioned in Crimea, it was a takeover nearly without a shot, to then just full out armed conflict? And did your experience in Crimea prepare you for what you would end up seeing in Eastern Ukraine? Or did it still come as a surprise of the level of violence that would occur?
Well, it prepared me in a way, because when I arrived back out in Eastern Ukraine, there were armed gunmen setting up checkpoints, checking IDs of people passing through them, certainly treating journalists with great skepticism. So there was this really tense atmosphere that felt initially much like Crimea. They were using the same terminology to describe anybody who was pro-Ukrainian, calling them, Banderovtsi, their version of a sort of like fascist. They were again very skeptical of journalists, especially foreign correspondents. So initially, it seemed and looked very similar, but it wasn't long before shots were being fired, and at that point, things really did change. I had to think more seriously about my personal security, how I would get around. At some point I made my way back to Kiev to grab a helmet, a vest, something that would allow me a little bit more protection before I returned. The one thing that helped me in Eastern Ukraine was that I knew the region very, very well, as opposed to Crimea, which I had only visited, I think, three times prior to going down there to report on the annexation. In Eastern Ukraine, where Russian troops had also sent in their little green men and were supported by gun-toting locals, I knew this area. I had crisscrossed the regions of Donetsk and Lugansk by bicycle, by bus, by train. I had friends there. I knew people who were on both sides of the emerging conflict. And so I had a lot of resources and contacts, and I knew my way around. That really helped me. But once things spiraled out of control, that was a completely different situation, and one that I had not found myself in. I never set out to be a war correspondent, a conflict reporter, nothing like that. And some journalists do, go out into the world and head over to the Middle East or head over to, someplace in Africa or now in Eastern Europe. And they want to be war correspondents. I did not want to be that person. I was much more of a journalist who thought of himself as a subject matter expert, that subject being Ukraine. And I really enjoyed my life in Kiev and being around in other places of the country. So, I learned as I went along. I spoke with some of the veteran correspondents who had seen what was going on and flew into Kiev and quickly rushed to where the action was. And they gave me some very good pointers and advice to keep me safe and also to do my job and ensure that I got some good reporting. And I think because of them and I think just my own good sense and really knowing that part of Ukraine very well, I was able to do what I think was a very good job of covering the early weeks and months of that first Russian invasion in 2014. And there's a lot of that in the book. I'm really proud of a lot of that reporting and some of the things that I was able to uncover, including war crimes committed by some of the Russian warlords in the city of Slavyansk, for example, or being one of the first journalists on the scene of the MH17 downing. But it was a completely different situation than Crimea.
So talking about the reporting that you did during that time period, one of the stories that really stood out to me was in, I believe, July 2014, you and another reporter found just a trove of documents from a Russian military officer named Igor Girkin. Can you talk about what you found and what that would lead to?
Yeah. First of all, I'll give you a little bit of background on Girkin for anybody who doesn't know him. Now he sits in a jail in Russia for speaking out against the Kremlin and its invasion in 2022 for saying that Putin isn't going hard enough on Ukraine. That's how radical he is. So he was this mustachioed war reenactor hobbyist who used to work for the FSB and was involved in a lot of Russia's covert invasions and wars prior to 2014. And then he helped Russia with its 2014 annexation of Crimea before he moved over to eastern Ukraine and became this warlord running the city of Slavyansk and a lot of towns around it in Donetsk Oblast. So he was ruling this area of eastern Ukraine with an iron fist, and everybody was terrified of him. And we correspondents who wanted to report out there had to go into his office to get to sort of apply for a press accreditation card so that we wouldn't get harassed on the streets by soldiers. And a lot of us went in there once and then swore we would not go back, myself included, because it was so terrifying. And so I sort of just kept a very low profile and tried to sneak around the town to do my reporting. And I was pretty successful because I knew it very well and I had a lot of contacts, even those on the pro-Russian side who trusted me enough to know that, I was not a threat. I was just doing my job. And so I was reporting on the war and the city the terror that was being sown by Girkin. And then in July, he actually withdrew his forces. Ukrainian troops were bearing down on the city and looking like they were going to storm it. And so Girkin pulled out his Russian and pro-Russian forces from Slavyansk, retreating back to the regional capital of Donetsk. And the next day, my friends Max Seddon and Noah Snyder, the three of us were doing a lot of reporting together and moving around together for security reasons. But also we had a lot of sources and contacts between us. And we moved into the city before a lot of the Ukrainian troops had entered it, but after Girkin had withdrawn his forces. So there was this short window of time where we sort of had the city to ourselves, and people were finally coming out of their homes to see what was going on and telling us these horrific stories. And a lot of them included tales about people disappearing at the building that Girkin was using as his office. So we made our way over to this building, and inside we found it completely torn apart. It looked like they tried to burn it to the ground to hide evidence of their war crimes. There was oil and gasoline and empty alcohol bottles all over the place, and a bunch of documents had been burned. And we found a stack, though, that had not been burned. They failed to detonate, it looked like. Some of them were soaked in oil, and others were saved because they were wrapped in plastic folders. So we started rifling through them. And, these are all documents written in Russian. And so we're kind of, meticulously looking through them, but also cautious of the fact that at any moment, police or local people could come in and maybe usher us out. And I think it was Noah who first noticed the words, military tribunal, and somewhere down the page, execution by firing squad. And we all just kind of stopped and looked at each other, reread those words, and then said, just grab everything. And so we just kind of bundled everything up we could into our jackets and backpacks, and we were filthy because it was all covered in soot and oil, and we hightailed it out of there. Actually, we came under an artillery attack on our way to a hotel, but we eventually made it there. We laid out all these documents, dried them, photographed all of them, and then started meticulously going through them and cataloging them. And what we found was that Girkin, while he was ruling the city of Slavyansk for more than a couple of months, had created this quote-unquote military tribunal that was judging people and arresting people for petty crimes, stealing clothes, breaking into people's homes, lifting cars, but also more serious crimes, and then ordering them to be executed by firing squad. And they were justifying this by saying that it was necessary to keep order, and they were doing it under a World War II era Stalin-imposed law. And it just seemed so insane and outrageous. And so that that night and over the next couple of days, I and Max and Noah each wrote our own stories around this and published them in our respective outlets. And it became a pretty big story and the first hard evidence of war crimes committed by Russia's soldiers in eastern Ukraine.
I mean, it was a really striking story reading it in the book. You went back to Ukraine, and I believe November, December of 2021, a couple months before Russia launched its, you know, full-scale invasion into the country. Can you talk about your decision to go back and then what it has been like in Ukraine in the nearly 2 years since this full-scale invasion?
Yeah, a lot's changed. And I did leave Ukraine, actually, in February of 2021, a year before the invasion, thinking that I would stay in New York. I'd done my time in Ukraine. I was trying my hand at a new beat covering national security after January 6th. And then Russia began building up its forces around Ukraine. So I went back at the end of 2021. And when I arrived back in Kiev, you know, I saw a lot of my old friends and contacts, sources in government, in the military. And, you know, a lot of people were really scared. They did think that something big was about to happen. And they were concerned that their president, Volodymyr Zelensky, was downplaying it. A lot of Ukrainians were reading the reports of Western intelligence saying that Russia was going to launch this large-scale military operation and invade the country. And so after a few weeks of being in Ukraine, my editors in New York were saying, you know, do you need to stay? Do you think it's going to happen? And I said, yeah, I do think it's going to happen. And sure enough, come February 24th, 2022, I'm out in eastern Ukraine because I was certain that it would begin where the war was already being fought. And I was in a hotel in the city of Krematorsk, just down the road from Slavyansk, which we were just talking about, where Girkin had been based a decade earlier, when the first missiles struck an airfield nearby and shook my hotel. And I quickly, you know, put my helmet and vest on and got to work reporting on, you know, what would be the biggest invasion of a European country since World War II. It was shocking. There was a lot of uncertainty, which I think in many ways was the scariest part. Obviously, when things are exploding around you, that is terrifying. But nobody knew how long it would last, where these missiles would be fired, where they would explode. You know, I remember my phone ringing constantly. It was not only family and friends back home in the U.S. checking in on me, but my Ukrainian friends asking me, "What do you know? What are you hearing? Where should we go?" And you know, I at that moment I didn't have a lot of answers. And you know, what was I going to tell them? And if I said to go to one place, and it ended up being unsafe, you know, I don't know if I'd be able to handle that. You know, and so unfortunately in that situation, I said, you know, I really don't know. I'm sorry. I'm trying to figure this out myself. And I'm also in a bad place and, was under attack. It was a very different feeling than 2014. You could sense that the scale of this attack was significantly greater. There was this feeling that everything would change. As it has, I think, not only in Ukraine, but across Europe, I think in the United States as well. You know, we are a major player in this. We're certainly Ukraine's biggest supporter when it comes to military assistance, and they rely heavily on us. You know, 2 years now into this full-scale invasion, the Ukrainians are running low on troops, on ammunition. In the U.S.,
There's now a heated debate in Congress about whether or not to provide $60 billion of assistance. And I think if it doesn't come, they're going to be in a world of trouble here in Ukraine. And I think that could mark a new phase in the war when Ukraine has to learn to survive on its own. I think that is a situation that could get really ugly really quickly. And it's also something that I think the United States will, you know, have to live with, knowing that they, you know, were largely responsible for what comes next. I hope we don't get to that point, and I'm somewhat hopeful that the U.S. and others will continue to provide support for Ukraine, because what is happening here now, I think, is a travesty. It's much greater than anything I saw in 2014 or the years after. And it's not over yet. And Vladimir Putin, Russia's president, has made clear that his goals have not been met. And so there's no reason to stop the war. And so it's going to grind on.
So on our Chatter podcast, we always ask our guests a question from the Chatterbox. And so the question today is, could you recommend a book, movie, or TV show other than your very excellent book, The War Came to Us, Life and Death in Ukraine? Do you have another book, movie, or TV show you could recommend?
Yeah, I think I will recommend something that I think will help to better understand Ukraine, a place I love dearly, but more specifically the eastern part of the country, which I think is always misunderstood and sometimes gets a bad rap, but is a really fascinating place and in some unusual ways, very welcoming. So I will recommend a book called Voroshilovgrad. I'll even spell it out because I know it's a tricky one. Voroshilovgrad. And Voroshilovgrad is the old name for the city of Lugansk, which is also the one of the regions in eastern Ukraine, Lugansk Oblast. And it's written by a Ukrainian author, poet, rock star, all around pretty cool guy named Sergei Jadan. It came out well before the full-scale invasion, and it's several years old now. It's a novel, not nonfiction, but there's so much truth in it. It's well written, translated into English. So if you don't speak Ukrainian or Russian, you can get an English language copy. And it's one of my favorite books that is just very scenic and colorful and packed with complex characters. And I think if you have an interest in learning about this part of Ukraine, then it's going to provide some really great insights.
I'll definitely put that on my list. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for chatting. It's been great.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at That Was Chatter.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.